I'm Glenn Ford.
And I'm Nellie Bailey.
Co-hosts of Black Agenda Radio. And you're listening to
PRN,
your source for progressive political viewpoints.
Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley. I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. Back when there was a TV show called The Dating Game, I was a 24-year-old contestant, and I won Rich Little. Some of you may not remember his name, but he was pretty well known at the time, a comic impersonator. And now with the Internet, anyone can play their own dating game online. And, of course, every year, hundreds of thousands of people find their perfect match through online dating services. And every year, hundreds of thousands become more discouraged from their experiences. So here to help us navigate the process is Dr. Pepper Schwartz, my friend and colleague. Welcome to the program, Dr. Pepper.
Thank you. Thank you. Great introduction.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Did you know that I was on the dating game back in?
No. I was fascinated. It must have been an incredible experience. I'm not sure that winning Rich Little would be my fondest dream. I'm delighted to hear that you won, but how was the date?
Oh, such a good question. Well, we had a pre-date before our dating game date. And it was, they flew us from Los Angeles, where I was living at the time, to San Francisco, and we stayed in separate rooms at the Fairmont. And then we had a wonderful night out on the town. It was quite remarkable. And then we did date afterwards for a while, but he wasn't as funny in person. And he was a little bit taken with himself. So anyway, but that was Rich Little.
I think those are both expectable, yeah. You know, it's interesting.
Yes.
People who are performers, I suppose we expect them to be, you know, what they put out there as a presentation, but that's not always the way it is. And I think that's true in real life. We all do presentations of ourselves, and then on a long-term basis, we're a little bit different.
Absolutely. So you're already getting into our discussion about your most recent book. What is this, book number 19, Pepper?
Yeah, it's about that. I mean, it's like crazy.
I mean, you are just so prolific, and you write so well. And this Dating After 50 for Dummies is a wonderfully organized book full of information. And it is published by AARP, and that's because you are the ambassador for AARP, the Sex and Relationship Ambassador. And I want to tell our listening audience that you're also a professor of sociology at the University of Washington, Seattle. And you are the former president of the Society for the Scientific Study of Sexuality. So that means I met you, maybe it was 20 years ago when you did that? Because I go to all of these conferences, and so I've known you a long time, even before I moved to Seattle.
Time passes so quickly.
Yes, it certainly does. Well, let's get into your book, because it has a lot to offer. And you, so you suggest that even though the title is Dating After 50, you wrote the book with people over 50 in mind, of course, but it contains information that applies to people far younger, and it is really true. This is a book, if you are listening and you are under 50, you must get this book even if you're under 50, because it will help you a lot. So let's begin, Pepper, with chapter one, and that is jumping back into the dating pool. This is, of course, this is particular to people after 50, because jumping back in, it can be challenging. Maybe one's priorities have changed. They may not be psychologically prepared for dating. Talk a little bit more about jumping back in.
Well, you know, it could even be someone who was 35. You know, you got married when you were right out of school. You had a couple kids, and then 15 years later, things break up, and there you are, you know, you haven't flirted in 15 years. And if you're older, it could be 30 years. And, you know, you just don't even know who you are or what you want. And so I think people should be reassured that if they're feeling like a fish out of water, so is everybody else who's out of circulation for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the, you know, the idea is that, you know, once you know that's normal, that you're no more inept than anybody else out there who hasn't done something in a long time, you can stop being so hard on yourself. I think when people have been gone from the dating room for a while and they've been, you know, raising kids or something, they feel maybe frumpy. They feel that, you know, nobody's going to want them. It's all not true. But if we don't watch out, we're going to so oppress ourselves that, you know, we'll convince ourselves we're unworthy when there's lots of people out there who are dying to meet us.
I mean, very, very good. So it helps to remain optimistic and to persevere. And when I moved to Seattle 5 years ago, I was still a widow. I'm still a widow, but so then 3.5 years ago, I met a man that you know, Brian, and it's a great match, match.com, and I'm so grateful that we met because we are so well suited to each other. So, but I had to literally kiss, literally, about 50 frogs before I found my prince. So it was very necessary for me to hang in and be optimistic.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, the fact is that it's not easy to meet the love of your life or even the partial love of your life. I mean, mm-hmm. you have to expect that it's going to take a little work. First of all, there's a learning curve mm-hmm. about, you know, what you want and who you're looking for and how to act with them. And secondly, you know, we're very special people. We're all quite unique. And I don't know why we would think that it wouldn't have to take a lot of work to meet somebody. Sometimes people do, and they give up way before they should. You have to be resilient. You have to think, okay, this is a learning experience as well as a dating experience. And every experience I have is learning. Every person I meet that wasn't right tells me something about what was right. Or everything I said that I shouldn't, now I know not to say it again. So if you think of it as growth rather than I had 3 dates and none of them were good, you will come out of this, you know, having fun, you know, having the experience as an experience, not necessarily as a disappointment. So I think sometimes people feel like, oh, I had 3 dates and I'm not good and they're not good and I'm stopping. And you can't do that. You have to think of, I always used to think that everybody has had at least one personal story worth hearing. Even if I would sit down and meet somebody and they were obviously on the surface wrong for me, I'd say, what's your story and how are they out here and how's it been for them? And I'll treat this like an interview situation where I learn something about life from this person, even if we never see each other again. So the idea is that, yes, you know, maybe they're frogs or maybe, you know, they're just a frog and you're a bird and you're two different species, but they're okay. You know, I mean, it's just frogs and birds don't get along. Like they're both okay. And that you should, and I think that's important to remember, you know, when you're evaluating yourself, when somebody who you meet, you think is great and, you know, they don't call again or they say no to you when you call, because again, if you're frogs and birds, it's not, there's something wrong. You're just different. And to get out of the judgment spec, to get out of the, if it doesn't work, if somebody doesn't want me that I wanted, to get out of the idea that has some larger meaning in life. It just really means you haven't met the right bird if you're a bird.
Yes, and I think sort of a corollary to this is don't judge a book by its cover. That
lots
of people have done it, dismissing a potential match for superficial reasons in hopes of finding somebody that we're instantly attracted to. And I think, you know, unlike movies, those love at first sight men, I'm now talking to the women, are often the very ones we should avoid, like the plague. And many women have what I call sometimes a broken picker. And just like the old song, we're looking for love in all the wrong places. And women don't seem to realize that many men are extremely nervous on first dates. So it takes time to get to know the real guy. So
Oh, it's true.
Give a guy a chance.
I think sometimes they, you know, somebody talks too much or they say something, you know, awkward, and somebody writes them off right away when they're not giving them a break about how hard it is to do this thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the biggest problem with online dating, where people are just too quick to think this won't work for them when they really haven't given it enough time to know. Sometimes first impressions are just wrong. And
yes.
there's nobody who knows what they need and who somebody is perfectly all the time. And if they think they do, they're really, I think, not being very perceptive about the fact that we all can jump to conclusions that don't turn out to be warranted.
Yes, let's go back, absolutely, and let's go back to the getting started. That your book is just so useful.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So you suggest that because a person is likely to have some fears, and
yes.
Hopes. And so my bias would be that sometimes a person needs to get involved with a little bit of psychotherapy to have, so that you can examine these and fears and hopes and brush up on some skills.
Well, I agree. I mean, I think if it isn't broke, don't fix it.
Right.
But if you're having unsuccessful times out there, either in terms of finding someone online or meeting people and it never goes on any further, or people you like just certainly weren't interested in you, I think, you know, you always have to consider, maybe it's not them, maybe it's me, maybe I am not acting in my best behalf. And in some ways you have to do that internal search about, you know, am I frightened? Am I defensive? Do I talk too much? Do I spill the beans too much? Am I in some ways not really ready to date, because I'm not having any success out there? And I honestly think if people are willing to take a good look at themselves first, they're going to do much better. I mean, I have met people, for example, who say, I'm not having any luck in dating. And, you know, as soon as I meet them, I talked to this one CEO type woman, and she was just such a tough cookie. She scared me. And I so finally said to her, I said,
you.
I mean, serious. Oh, she did. I was like, oh, my God. She's going to get mad at me any minute, you know. And I told her. I said, I really did. I said, you know what? You come across as needing no one and being tough and judgmental. And has anyone ever told you that? And she said, she took a minute. She said, well, yeah, my staff tells me that.
Yeah.
So I said, you know, I bet you have wonderful qualities. I bet you have you've made a successful business. People must respect and like you. You can't have a good business without that. But you can't show that, just that executive tough cookie to the world. You have to show to men that you have vulnerabilities and you're emotional, that you can be warm and you can be accepting and you can be open. And she says, I don't know how to do that. And I said, well, then that's your first task. Your first task is to do that. And if you need professional help to do it, go get it.
So that first step, which is to get more in touch with the softer feminine side that is not so damn self-sufficient every minute.
Right, because everybody wants to feel like, you know, this person needs them and wants them and has the capacity to love. And this woman has all that, but she wasn't showing it.
She wasn't showing it. Exactly. So, yeah, so examining, I like what you say, that maybe you need to first look at yourself and before you jump back into the dating pool. You also talk in the book about identifying your core requirements for deep and permanent love. And our priorities do change. I noticed that about myself when I was searching for love after my late husband died, and my priorities changed, and they were actually for the better. You know, they were healthier.
Well, you know, one of the things about getting a little older is you do get a little wiser.
Yes.
And so the kinds of things maybe you were more interested in, status issues or looks issues or something like that when you're younger, And then you get old and you go like, you know what? I'm looking for character. You know, I'm looking for somebody, you know, who I can trust, who has capacity to take care of me, who wants to be that kind of partner, you know, all of those kinds of things. And maybe it's time for an attitude readjustment and a difference in what I'm looking for. One of the things I tell people is, you know, in that you can't make a long list. You make a really long list, and my word for you is lonely. Because
Pepper. Yes, you can't make a long list.
You know, and if you do, you're making your ratio of success much less likely. So take like the top three things really matter to you. Maybe it's their income is secure. Maybe it's that they're funny and they're entertaining to be with. And maybe it's that they share some of your biggest values and goals about life. Okay, then. That's it. But you can't have 20 other things. You know, you have to really pick, like, what's this really about? What are my central core requirements? And then let everything vary and be open to something different than you initially, you know, are going to put in this long list.
That is exceptional advice. Also in your book, you go into, we've touched on a little bit, but let's look at it more. So you've got polishing your conversational skills, and lots of people need help with this, especially if they're past 50 and getting back into the dating game. But even younger people, and especially more introverted people who have trouble with small talk. And you probably have heard of Bernardo Carducci. He's researched shyness.
Hello.
And he was at Stanford, now he's at Indiana University. And so he suggests four things, and I'll just cover them briefly, and I'd love for you to respond, and then we'll talk more about what's in your book. The opening line, so that should be a comment about your shared environment, like, so how do you know somebody here, whoever that person is? And don't pressure yourself to have a brilliant opening line. You just have to be nice, is what Carducci says.
Right, right.
And
I think that's true. I think if you try to be clever or too stagey, people are going to know, and they're going to say, this person's not for real.
Not for real. And then he says, with introductions, offer more than your name and occupation. Give some details that allow for conversation. I think that's good advice.
I think it is, because nobody knows what to say next if you don't help them know.
Exactly. And then asking questions. The secret to good conversation is to make the other person feel interesting. And that's always so true. And a lot of times more introverted people are pretty good at that, at listening and asking questions, because they don't really want to be the focus of attention.
Right, right. And I think the asking questions is an important thing. I'm glad you mentioned that, because one of the things, people think they have to be so entertaining and tell so much that they start talking a blue streak, and of course then there's no room for anybody else to get anything in, and they get bored. So I think a really good, if you're worried about this, I think a really, really good thing to do is just to ask questions. Tell me about yourself. That's interesting. Why did you get into that? And, you know, where did it go from there? And what are you planning on next? And tell me more. I just find this fascinating. I mean, all of that really doesn't make you have to be a sparkling conversationalist. It just makes you have to be interested and ask follow-up questions.
In your book, you say on page 15, be a good listener. When people are nervous, they have a tendency to either clam up or not know how to turn off a torrent of words. One way to know if you're listening is to ask the other person questions about herself. And so you say it very well in your book, ask questions. And anyway, people love to feel that sort of attention, that you're truly interested in them.
Yeah, and that's why a follow-up question is important, because if you only ask one question, how interested were you? But if you ask a follow-up question, if they say, well, you know, I just changed jobs, and you don't ask, well, what did you change to and why, but you go like, oh, that's interesting, and you move on, you weren't really interested. You know, you have to kind of follow up, you know, and see what was it? You know, have them know you're tracking and
really,
find out
yes.
about them. And, of course, one of the ways you know if somebody mm-hmm. is someone you want to continue to talk to is if they ask you follow-up questions, if they're interested enough in what you're saying to ask a little more, to get a little more information.
Precisely, precisely. You also talk about being resilient, and I remember what the Japanese say. They say, be a bamboo inside, that Western people have... Yeah, Western people have mm-hmm. backbones of steel, and so stresses come against this backbone of steel, and eventually it'll snap. But if you're a bamboo inside, you can bend with the stressors, bend with the wind, be strong but resilient. And so I always think about that, be a bamboo. And, of course, being resilient is a sign of good mental health, along with a corollary, it seems to me, is to have a high tolerance for ambiguity.
Oh, I like that. I do, because people often mm-hmm. wonder, what are you, and who are you, and what do you do? And in a sense, you know, all that can be revealed over you. You don't have to know every single thing immediately, and you don't have to have everything in order to start to like somebody and know them. I think ambiguity in the beginning of a relationship is almost unavoidable. Mm-hmm. And you'll find out much more, you know, if you allow it to develop in a little bit normal way rather than, you know, sort of ask somebody, you know, every single thing about them like a job interview.
Yes, yes. Also in your first section, Getting Started, you talk on page 24 about having a relaxed face. And I thought this was really important to put into the book. I've never seen it written about before. And it's under your tip, and you say, look at your face in the morning when you leave, at least once during the day, and when you come home at night. Is your face relaxed? Is it friendly? If not, soften your eyes and mouth and relax your expression. Work on looking pleasant and happy as a natural state of being. It makes you so much, if you have that sort of face, it makes you so much more sort of welcoming to somebody new or inviting or, you know, people will, I think, are much more likely to talk to you if you have this relaxed face.
I think so, and I think a lot of people really don't know how their face looks if they don't look in the mirror and practice having it look relaxed and accepting and warm. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't know how they come off. They think they're looking okay, but they're actually looking uptight, judgmental, and sometimes even a little angry. And so if sometimes you just have to do that facial exercise. Practice the face you want to show to the world and look at it so you know what you're doing.
Yeah, really good advice, Dr. Pepper. Such good advice.
Thank you.
And then right after that, you make another point that I think is very useful for lots of people. If you tend to get depressed when things don't work out right away, put a list of things you're grateful for on your bathroom mirror or your refrigerator door. And make sure you remind yourself of all the good things in your life. And that's encapsulating living with gratitude, or gratitude as an attitude. It makes all the difference, doesn't it?
Well, it does, because it's very hard to put on a good face if inside you're hurting, if inside you're feeling unworthy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is so much, you know, we Americans have to be grateful for. I mean, even if we're working hard and we're in jobs that we're not appreciated in, we have jobs. We have worked. You know, we might have a child. We might have gotten some kudos over time. We might have close friends who value us. I mean, there's so many things that are really important for good life that we forget to remember, and then we forget to be thankful for. And when you develop a sense of gratitude, you also get to a much more pleasant space in your mind, which shimmers off of you. A person who is grateful for life feels good to be around.
It's very, very true, of course. You're always glad to be around somebody. Well, kind of the corollary is it's nice to be around somebody who's in love and who's not bitter.
One of the things I have seen in the dating market, mm-hmm. For both men and women, is they are bitter about some things that have happened, often a bad divorce. You know, things didn't go mm-hmm. well, and they may be quite right. They may have really been treated badly. But if they talk about it and they let it take them over, even if the other person understands how badly they've been treated, they don't want to be around it. They just don't want to be all that negative energy. So if you're bitter, get over it. And if you can't, at least hide it, because it's going to sabotage you. It's going to sabotage new relationships.
You're very wise, of course. We go back to maybe doing a lot of self-reflection, which can be done in therapy with a good psychotherapist, somebody that a person feels like there's a fit.
And sometimes even a coach. I mean,
or
I think
a coach,
what everyone
of course.
Has,
it doesn't have to be a licensed psychotherapist, right?
I think there's
some very good coaches.
Yeah. Because coaches are usually a little less expensive, and you know, sometimes they can be just really good on practical things.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So we will talk after the break about the online dating scene, and you've got some really good advice about writing your profile, which is essential that you have a really lively and accurate profile. And I also want us to talk about sex, because navigating a potential sexual relationship when you started to date online can be tricky. And the book is so full and useful, but then I sort of jumped ahead to challenges to overcome and signs of a solid and worthy relationship. But let's give a little preview before we go to the break about writing a good online profile. Do you think it's useful for people to get some help with this if they can't seem to be objective or they're insecure about writing their profile?
I think that's a great idea, because I think a lot of people get so inhibited about writing their profile, they don't do anything. They don't get online because they can't get past that. And sometimes they're right to be worried. You know, they're not good at sort of expressing themselves or presenting themselves to the world, and they could use some help. And I think nobody should post a profile without some close friend looking at it and saying, you know, does that really tell somebody who you are? I often think people are so over modest when they write a profile that they err to making themselves look too humble, too uninteresting. They don't really sell themselves. It's almost like you were going into a job interview and saying, "Here's why you shouldn't hire me." You know, and just like don't do that.
Imagine
how that would be your
Sorry. That's really self-defeating. This is why you shouldn't hire me. I'm glad you put it that way, because it's a job interview.
Yeah, I mean, you're being interviewed for the job of partner, lover, date, you know, and you have to put it out there about, like, why you're a good candidate. And that means putting out a profile that does you justice. Now, sometimes you need a friend to help you with that, because they'll say, why didn't you just say that when you were younger, you won the, you know, state speech contest, or, you know, and that you really love words and you love reading and that you've actually a published poet. Why didn't you put any of that? You know, that's all really interesting to the right person. Or why didn't you say that, you know, you were homemaker of the year, or that you actually, you know, climbed three mountain peaks, or whatever it is that somebody who really thinks that's cool would want to know. And then you also want them to go over for grammar and spelling and all that stuff, because, you know, we all make those mistakes, but remember, people are looking at these things very quickly, and you need to have nothing that's disqualifying just because people are trying to use very little information to make some selections because they don't often want to, you know, be with somebody who they think, you know, is not educated or doesn't care enough to proofread their work or something like that. And so you could miss people just for a little stupid mistake that isn't really even usually the one you do. So that's why I always think before you hit that send button, it's really good to have somebody who's a good friend and an honest friend take a look at everything you've said and done and see if it really represents you well and if you've made any mistakes that, you know, seem minor but someone might take as major.
Pepper, such good advice and very well expressed, and I hope our listeners are really taking notes because this is excellent. So we will talk more when we come back from the break, so stay with us. And Pepper and I will talk more about writing your profile, and then we're going to get into sex because that's always fun, and more. So stay with us, and we'll be right back.
Cosa leggerai? Con che libro affascini il tuo cuore?
We are back. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I'm here with Dr. Pepper Schwartz, my friend, my colleague. She is brilliant and very prolific in her writings because her 19th book, imagine 19 books, Dating After 50 for Dummies, the Dummies series, and it's a very well-organized book and so chock full of information. So you will want to get this book. If you want to know a little more about Pepper, go to her website, pepperschwartz.com. And I'll put that up when I do the summary of this program afterwards. So maybe we need to jump right to sex. We talked about the online profiles. Well, we both like to talk about sex. We know that.
Yeah.
So you have in your book pinpointing the origins of your love map, and that a love map is created from many sources, and all of them are quite powerful. So you highlight your parents, your early experiences, and pop culture. And, of course, each one of these points we can spend a lot of time on, but we won't in this program, but love maps, they are powerful ways to kind of conceptualize one's sexuality. Can you talk a little bit more about love maps?
Well, I think it's the way we were brought up. It's the models we have in front of us. It's the way we grew up thinking love should work. It's some things that we've gotten, you know, really in our bloodstream by living a certain way, watching a certain way, and we have these expectations based on them and comforts based on them that sometimes we grow out of and sometimes, no, they're just instinctively us. They're the way we relate in a relationship. They're who we find attractive. You know, why does somebody find some only blondes attractive and other people find only dark people attractive? It's not entirely clear how these things get formed, but some of them are very stubborn. I mean, even if you want to change them, they're at the unconscious comfort level that is a map that our responses follow. Even if we feel like we should be more flexible, we may not be more flexible.
And it all has to do with the influence of often early factors. And,
it could be very early, way before you even remember it.
Right. And pop culture, you write, in the 50s, having ample hips, a tiny waist, and huge breasts was the epitome of female sexiness. These days.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So sort of you think Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah, it's very culturally prescribed, you know, or Twiggy, uh-huh. who was a model who was very thin and had very small breasts. I mean, it's these things that start to emerge out of the culture. Some person sort of does a model-breaking vision of what's sexy or what's attractive, and then we all start to fold right in because that's what we learned. That's how we now, those are our cultural guides. And yes, you know, it sounds like it's, you know, we should have more choice than that, but some of this just gets into our vision of what we want. And, you know, sometimes we change it over time, but sometimes we don't.
I think that some women who are confident and aging do get more comfortable with their bodies, even their not so perfect bodies, and the men who love them appreciate of their voluptuousness and the fact that they are comfortable, that they're not focusing on the their breasts or their chubby thighs or, you know, whatever, that they're just present in the moment and enjoying their sexuality and not being so, I mean, I know that happened to me. I was much more conscious of my chubby thighs in my 20s, and now I'm just glad my body works as well as it does, even though it's not so perfect.
Well, I think that's right, and I think the people who are happy and healthy in their older years are the men and women who say, hey, I'm not disqualified because I don't have the body of myself at 25, and also the people who are younger who say, you know, well, I am what I am, and someone's going to like it and want it. And not things that were reduced to our thighs or our chest or our arms or all the things that we used to take pride in when we were young.
Yeah.
Even young people, there's many people who don't have perfect bodies just because they're young, you know. And the idea is if you can appreciate your body and feel entitled to pleasure.
Entitled to pleasure.
And that's going to be the sexiest thing you can show.
Yes. Entitled to pleasure, and kind of what goes along with that, I think, is that a woman who feels entitled to pleasure is much more likely to be uninhibited, to let go, to have fun. And a study of some 500 men, not a big study, showed that the number one thing they wanted in their female lover was enthusiasm, followed up secondly by a willingness to initiate sex. So that I think by implication that indicates that she's comfortable in her body and she's comfortable with her sexuality.
I totally agree, and those findings are exactly what I would have said.
Okay.
That men want enthusiasm. When they say a woman's good in bed, what they mean is she likes it. She expresses it.
Yeah.
And she may or may not, I don't think she has to do the full 9 yards of everything there is to do, but she has to love what she does and express that and give feedback. In my own study, one of the things the men wanted most was noise from the woman. Because they just wanted to know they were doing okay, you know? They want some feedback. They want some appreciation.
Right. And of course, your book just before this, or maybe it was two before this, The Normal Bar, and we did discuss that on a previous show on this program. So that was part of your research too, wasn't it, in The Normal Bar?
Right. So we were looking at those things in The Normal Bar just to see what men and women wanted in all areas of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
But that goes on in dating too, and it doesn't change when people are older. They don't have to look perfect to be desirable, and all they have to believe is that they are desirable and show it, and that will be a really great attractant to the other person who's, you know, talking to them and trying to find out. I think men, and this is true particularly among the older group, men are worried that a woman isn't going to like sex at all. So if she's showing it any kind of sensuality, they're going to be very reassured, you know?
Yes, that's right. And so many women need to feel desirable from their lover before they can feel desire. So when they
feel... Well, I say act as if.
Yes, I do too. Act as if, and realize that, in fact, arousal may precede desire so that the woman begins to feel aroused in the sexual relationship, and then the desire kicks in. So that's acting as if.
And so, I think when you're just dating, there's usually, you know, if there's a spark, that the desire and the arousal are not going to be so big a problem in the sense this is all very new. But you might be frightened. You might need to talk about it. A lot of people will have not had sex for a very long time. They're not sure. Real, and some people have had sex with only one person, and they're not sure what it would be like with someone else. And I think the best thing to do is to be able to express that when you're dating for a while and things are moving towards that, or it may move much more quickly these days than it would have when the last time you dated. You can say, you know, look, I have to take things slowly because, you know, that's who I am, or, you know, here's what I'm feeling, but I'm a little nervous. I want you to know that. I mean, conversation about these things is not only possible, but extremely important.
Extremely important. And you have some really helpful points in your book. Again, Dating After 50. Creating your sexual philosophy. So you're encouraging people to really ask these questions. How early in a dating relationship do I feel that touching and kissing intimately are appropriate? Do I have different standards about oral sex and genital touching than I do about sexual intercourse? Would I be able to explain this to my partner? And skipping a little bit, what kind of discussion about sexual health, including condoms, would I have to have before sex would occur? These are really important questions, and lots of people bypass them. They're scared. They don't know how to put it to words. So a little practice might help.
Well, as you know, in the book, I have a lot of model conversations you could have about how it would look if you say this and the next person said that. And kind of give guides about how the conversation should proceed, because these are awkward conversations. And if you sort of begin them the right way, they probably will proceed in a way that is useful and not as embarrassing as you might imagine. The one on condoms is really important because, after all, in the beginning of dating, you do not know where this person's been sexually. They do not know where you have been. They do not know what kind of hygiene you really practice. And, you know, you yourself may not know, because you haven't, you know, thought about sex for a long time outside your past relationship, you know, what really is your health situation. Should go get checked out, for sure. But in any case, I think the one thing to say is just don't make it personal. Say, look, I don't have sex without a condom. Is that a problem? And if it is, let's talk about it so we can work on it. Because, you know, some men who haven't had sex in a long time, they don't want condoms. They think that they'll make it harder for them to perform or stuff like that. But it's in everybody's interest to have this dialogue and do it right.
And I know that you've been involved a little bit with the condom manufacturer. Which one is it again?
Trojan. I'm on the
advisory council. Yeah, Trojan. You're on the board, right?
So
they famously say, and I like it, that the condom today is not your grandfather's condom.
Oh no, they're so much better. They're very thin. Some of them are more like a sex toy than a condom. There's one called Ecstasy that has an inner condom that fits very loosely, but tight around the bottom so that it's secure. And then there's a thin band of lubricant over that, and then there's another thing over that, and it's all very thin, so a little friction internally with the condom. And people say it just makes sex better. Not, you know, it's not a compromise, it's a turn on.
Well, isn't that wonderful? And then you have safer sex in the process. Well, it's just that I read, and this goes back a few years, but I think it's still true, that sexually transmitted diseases, especially the dreaded one, HIV, had gone up in some senior communities in Florida.
No, it's true. There was a couple percentage of people who had HIV, and I think it's very important to, even though, you know, probably the highest rates of things like chlamydia or gonorrhea or whatever, somewhere in the 6-8%, but that's a lot of people. And even though it's not most people, you know, so what? You don't want to be the unlucky one, right?
Exactly.
So basically, I just say, hey, protect yourself and the other person, and just presume that this is a health behavior, just like it was a zillion years ago, that everybody does, and just say, hey, I don't know my own stuff that, you know, I might, you know, I think I'm fine, but, you know, I haven't tested myself, and or I have, but I don't know if that's, you know, complete. And I just think for just even, you know, different kinds of flora and stuff like that, let's just do this, because this is the way we do it these days. And
so you make it more matter of fact.
Yeah, matter of fact. This is what we do. It's not about you. It's just the way that sex should be done these days, unless you're in a long-term committed relationship where you've made, you know, certain kinds of promises that you want to, you know, make sure you follow. But, you know, in the beginning of a relationship, you don't know what its trajectory is, and this is the best way to proceed.
And then in your book, you have explaining how you want to be made love to and giving instructions. And I really liked your opening sentence after giving instructions. When providing your new sexual partner with feedback and direction, make sure to use a conversational tone rather than a corrective one. After all, no one wants a lover who feels like a traffic cop directing each move. Hear, hear. The secret to giving instructions without sounding overly dictatorial is talking about it first out of bed. Expand on that a little bit, Pepper.
Right. I mean, when you're in the moment, you do the best you can. But after it's over and you're having a glass of wine or a cup of coffee or whatever, you know, you could say, that was really great. You know, I love the way you kiss, but you know, sometimes I like to really be kissed hard. You know,
mm-hmm.
I didn't know how to say that, but you know, that would really thrill me. And the person is going to go like, yay, you know, you didn't criticize what they did do, but you're saying, I've got this other need or this other desire. Or, you know, I loved when you grabbed me, but I didn't tell you how black and blue I get really easily. So I need a lighter touch because, you know, otherwise I'm going to look like I got beat up. It's not your fault, but it's just the way I am. Or, you know, whatever it is, you know, or like, you know, we didn't do this, but I would love to do that to you. And would you like it? I mean, is that something you like? I mean, you know, you can have these conversations, and because if they're not happening in the middle of it, they're not a criticism. They're just exploring each other's sexuality, and everybody likes to do that.
And you're much more likely to have better sex,
yeah.
sex when you've had these discussions, and even the discussions feel like you're more emotionally intimate because you're being open, you're being vulnerable. And that's about emotional intimacy before you have the physical intimacy.
Yeah, it will make you feel like this is more of a relationship as opposed to an act.
As opposed to a what? I didn't hear the word.
As opposed to an act, as opposed to a behavior.
Of course, right. So, and there's so much more in that chapter about Let's Talk About Sex, that whole section of your book. You have also challenges to overcome, and I'm now looking at page 261. And I think that some older women in particular have this experience. You have a great online presence, but no one responds. That's got to be really sort of devastating for some women. And what do you do?
Well, first of all, you have to have a friend come in and say, take a look at this.
Mm-hmm.
Because you may think it's great, but it might not look great. Or your friend could say, that's not a flattering picture of you. Or you mentioned your dead husband here. Or you know, so let's say it's all good, and then they say, well, who are you looking for? And they show you the people you've been looking for, and you go like, you know what? They're all younger than you or the same age. These guys like a woman 5 years younger. Why don't you go a little older? Well, I don't want an older person. Well, they don't want one either. So what are you going to do here? You know, look at a different kind of person. All of your guys have to have advanced degrees. Is that really necessary now? Why don't you take a look at guys without degrees? Some of them have a lot of world experience that are interesting. Or just, you know, college or finish high school, whatever. You're looking at only the most handsome people online. Well, they have a lot of competition, hun. Why don't you look for guys that are nice looking, but, you know, have really interesting write-ups. In other words, there's probably something that you're not doing that you could be doing that would give you a different result.
So well said. And again, I'm so glad this program is archived because people need to listen to this and really take it in. You've had many years and many experiences to become so wise and clear.
Well, you get older, you learn something, right?
Well, right. If you keep your eyes open, you learn and improve. But, I mean, this book is really, really good. I can't encourage our listeners enough to get it, no matter what your age, Dating After 50. The Dummies brand, I see that it's a Wiley brand, my name.
Right, right. Wiley is the publisher.
Yes, I know.
Yep. Yeah, it's Dating After 50 for Dummies. It's not like I'm calling people dummies. The whole series is a Wiley series for dummies. I meant to mention something like that when you said AARP is a co-sponsor, but the publisher does a whole series of books.
Right.
And the whole Dummies brand is just to say, hey, we can do this simple. We can take you step by step, and it'll be easy and fun to do.
Yes, and I know two people. One is Dr. Walter Bortz, who did Aging for Dummies, and he's a geriatrician, and I did my aging and sexuality studies with him in the early 90s, which were published in medical journals. So that's how I got to call myself a gerontologist.
Cool.
And then I remember interviewing, when I had the radio show in Hawaii years ago, so the Dummies, Meditation for Dummies. And I'm now forgetting his name, but it just was such a good book. There's so many books, and it simplifies things. They're organized. You've got tips. You've got remember. You've got warnings, the little icons in the book. So it's very clear reading. So before we have to end, because we have to end a couple minutes before the top of the hour, signs of a solid and worthy relationship. And I like this. Your first point is your date is always or almost always on time. Being on time is respectful, isn't it?
It is.
People that are chronically late, just they don't seem to respect other people's time.
Yeah, and I think when you're just sort of meeting someone in the beginning, if they can't get it together for the beginning of a relationship, good grief, what is it going to be once they get comfortable?
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. And you say your date's relationship with family and friends are warm and intact. Yeah, look at the family. Look at the friendships. Can tell you a lot, right?
Absolutely. A person, particularly a grown-up at the age we're talking about, should have been able to create solid friendships, solid family relationships. They could have been unlucky and, you know, had a bad set of parents or something, or, you know, a crazy brother or whatever, but there should be some background that shows that they are able to form and appreciate and build and keep relationships. And if it's not there, there's a good reason for it, and I would be very careful of a person like that.
I would be,
if
too.
If they couldn't do it.
Yes, and you say your date tells you how much you mean to him or her. You should feel adored. And isn't that the best feeling, Pepper? I think we both have men in our lives who help us feel adored and desired. And I just feel so grateful for that. You know,
it solves a lot of issues, because if you feel really loved and adored and appreciated, you know, every relationship is going to have problems, but if you have that solid foundation, almost everything is possible.
Oh, what a great way to end this program. Almost anything is possible. Thank you, Pepper. Once again, you've been just a fabulous guest, and I want people to know that they can learn more about you again at pepperschwartz.com. Get this book. And I also want people to know that next week, May 6th, Dr. Scott Halsman will return, and his book is Surviving, The Secrets to Surviving Infidelity. So So we'll go to another level of relationships.
Right.
Pepper, thank you again.
It was my pleasure, and I should mention that I think it's drpepperschwartz.com, drpepperschwartz.com.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yes, it is.
No, don't worry about it.
Yes, it is, and I'll put that in the archive. Yes, of course. So I'll put that in the description, and people will be able to go to it. So thank you, Pepper.
A lot of fun.
We'll talk again soon.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good, Pepper. Bye. Bye, everybody. Okay. Tune in next week, Dr. Scott Holtzman. Bye-bye.